Coming up in This Week in Computer Hardware, AMD Vega 7, new Ryzen CPUs, RTX 2060, the Asus Pro Art Monitor is amazing, and one TV I can't stop talking about. It's part one of our CES 2019 coverage. Coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 499, recorded on January 10th, 2019. AMD Radeon 7, new Ryzen CPUs, NVIDIA's RTX 2060. It's CES 2019. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by OnDeck. Are you a small business owner in need of capital today? OnDeck can help. With over $10 billion in loans and an A-plus rating from the Better Business Bureau, OnDeck is a lender you can trust. Find out more at OnDeck.com/Twitch. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch Weekly Show that aims to bring you those useful, most engaging, most informative, and occasionally most slurred introductions with the least used of consonants ever recorded at the Twitch production facility. I'm Patrick Norton. I'm in the media room somewhere between the Venetians and the Sands here in Las Vegas, and freshly returned home, showered, and I suspect, if he's lucky and the baby didn't cry all night, relaxed. Sebastian Peek joins us from PC Purr. Are you feeling good about what you saw at CES this year, Sebastian?
I am, and yes, I am well. I'm well rested, showered. I'm comfortable right now. I'm warm. I have my home around me. You know, Patrick, there's no place like home, truly. But yeah, I'm sorry. I skipped out early and left you there. I apologize.
It's okay. But I did get a special treat. And I waited in a press event that lasted considerably longer than it was supposed to because I was so full of hope that it would show up. And we'll talk about AMD's announcements in a second. But I should ask you, there are two big GPU announcements this week, NVIDIA RTX 2060, AMD Vega 7. One of these things is not like the other, haha. And I think we kind of extensively discussed what we thought the 2060 was going to be this last week. How are you? I mean, it's we pretty much have the price, the performance. You guys have preliminary numbers up on PCPer.com. This is looking like the card that's officially going to beat the 10 series cards in the submission.
Yeah, it's an interesting product because it's really not what I would have expected before I saw performance based on the name. Like, if we look at the previous generation, like X60 cards, like the 1060 or the 960, right. 760. These were really your mainstream kind of 1080p gaming cards. And this is kind of a new category. Like, looking at the core, just to look at specs just a little bit, this is based on the same core as the 2070.
Right.
So it's like a modified version of the TU-106. It has 1920... cores, and it operates at a little bit lower base clock than the 2070 out of the box. But of course, we haven't tested like the board partner versions of this yet. And it has 6 gigabytes of GDDR6 memory, so it still has quite a bit of memory bandwidth, even though it's been reduced from 448 down to 336 gigabytes a second. So it's a more efficient card that still has quite a bit of power, and so much power, in fact, that this almost feels like the Ti. Like if there had been like a 2060 right. Ti. I know there wasn't a 1060 Ti. There was a 1060 6 gigabyte and a 3 gigabyte. So we'll see if there are going to be further versions of this. But the numbers really show this to be somewhere in between like 1070 and 1080 levels, where depending on what you're doing, you're sometimes neck and neck with a 1080. You're pretty much always above a 1070. So and over last year's 1060 6 gigabyte, there's literally about a 2x improvement. So it's completely kind of out of that mainstream performance level almost. But really, honestly, the price tag is a little out of the mainstream too. Like, this is a $349 part, and that, you know, it's a little bit out of some people's comfort zone. It's a little bit out of where maybe somebody might be looking for that true mainstream, like $200 to $250, like 1080p card. But we have yet to see what's coming from NVIDIA, because I'm sure if they're following along the previous years, traditions. There'll be a 2050, like a 1050 replacement, maybe a 1050 Ti replacement. So those will be really interesting lower cost cards. But performance of this, and I have the card here, and we had the Founders Edition card to test initially. Mm-hmm. Further testing with other cards to come, but very, very impressive, very powerful performance, and kind of feels right, like as far as performance and price. Maybe a little bit less performance for a lower price is coming, but $349 for what this can do. And we saw some interesting demos at NVIDIA's suite at CES where they were showing like a gaming, like a streaming content creator setup where they were using a 2060 for their gaming, and then the 2060 is actually able to offload video encoding from the CPU while gaming and sending out the stream at the same time. So there, it's absolutely like a kind of a workhorse 1080p product that's also aimed at like the 1440p enthusiast sector. Right. Not so much 4K. So if they were to label these based on resolution, this would be like your ultimate 1080 or like your 1440p card, and then like the 2080, 2080 Ti are like your 4K cards. So
I got to say, you know, I've been, because I need a short 215 millimeter card for a build I'm doing. And I'm like, you know, I'll get a 1060, I'll get a 1070. It's you know, there's not much in the way of RTX ray tracing gaming out there. It's going to be a while. I can wait. And I look at this card at this price. I mean, you know, outperforming a 1070 Ti, do you feel comfortable saying that, or at least performing at parity with?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's right in the middle of the 1070 and 1080, so...
Yeah, so that's, you know, and those cards are now selling for, you know, 1070 Ti's are selling for $500. And that's kind of why I said at the beginning of this, you know, this is the card that's kind of finally going to beat the 10 series cards into submission. And, you know, unless you happen to need a 250 millimeter card, you don't feel like waiting for the short 2060s to come out. But this is a, when you look at the existing cards, like, you know, 10 series 1060s are all the way up around, you know, $300 right now. As supply, I think, finally tapers off. So if you've been thinking about a 1060, it is a no-brainer to get the 2060 instead. You're going to get a massive increase in performance for about, you know, in terms of 6 gigabyte cards. You know, maybe you're going to pay $100 more. And it's, I get, you know, also what you're saying earlier, because 350, well, for 1080p performance is a bargain. But if you're a 1080p gamer, 350 is like, you know, you were probably looking forward to getting a $180 or $200 card, but I'm kind of really curious to see how they fill out the rest of the lineup and what they kind of do, or if they do an alternate to the RTX series, because it seems like once you get much lower than the 2060 in terms of performance, I think ray tracing is going to be pretty hard to do.
They did show some demos with ray tracing on the RTX 2060, but I think the interesting story there is going to be when we can implement DLSS. And just to briefly explain what that is, it's the deep learning super sampling for anti-aliasing. They compared it side by side with TAA, like the temporal anti-aliasing. And the Port Royal demo just came out while we were there, of course. So coming back home, that's a new benchmark. It's like the industry standard 3D mark benchmark for ray tracing. But what is not yet enabled in that benchmark is the DLSS support, and that is coming. And they had a pre-release version to show side by side. And essentially what you're getting with DLSS is about the same visual quality, if not in certain cases actually better. Like the way that they explained it and the way that it looked in person was it's able to intelligently identify, like defining the edges of objects so it can maintain sharpness at the edge, and the smoothing happens like throughout the image. So it ends up being a little bit less soft looking than just TAA does. So, but the big thing is the performance improvement. So it was running at significantly higher frame rate with DLSS. And on the other side of the room, I saw a demo running on a 2060 that looked absolutely playable. So when we get DLSS support in games, I know it's coming to Shadow of the Tomb Raider. And I know Battlefield 5 has been kind of the poster child of ray tracing so far. Mm-hmm. When we get that support in games, I think that will be an even bigger story for the 2060 because it's a fully ray tracing capable card. And their messaging for the 2060 has really been that it's a 1440p gaming card. So if you're that enthusiast who wants like the ultra wide, like, you know, whatever by 1080 monitor, or if you have like a 1440p gaming monitor, like a high refresh monitor, this is the card. And I imagine there will be a 1080 focused solution coming later.
It makes sense to me. I mean, I'm not going to repeat what you just said. DLSS is fascinating.
It's mysterious and fascinating. Like the little I've read about it, it's like I would love to like dive into this and find out exactly what it's doing. But it's the results are definitely impressive as far as the fact that it's more efficient because it's using fewer samples and the frame rates are absolutely higher. So
it's in case people are like, well, why don't you know more about this? It's because NVIDIA hasn't really shared much information. And when they got into the Turing architecture, this is how they explained DLSS. DLSS leverages a deep neural network to extract multidimensional features of the rendered scene and intelligently combine details from multiple frames to construct a high-quality final image. Using fewer input samples than traditional tech. You know what I mean? It's like it was very like...
Yeah, I read that too. It's a little ambiguous, but...
A little
it's like
ambiguous.
Their secret sauce.
And Vegas is kind of loud. Yeah, but it's also that is a total secret sauce moment, because what they're saying is we're going to use fewer samples. We're going to do a better quality rendering. We're going to, you know, enable lower power cards to do more extraordinary things. You know, and we're going to use AI to do it. And, you know, back off, kid. We'll let you see it when it's done and you can tell us how cool it is.
You know, that reminds me of when I was getting into talk about VR headsets that use eye tracking to enable like more intelligent foveation. Like when you have just the area of focus is all you really need to have rendered at high resolution with high textures, and the rest of it can kind of gently blur off into the background. DLSS almost sounds like the same kind of idea, where it intelligently decides what needs to be done to make it look good. Mm-hmm. Instead of just everything has to be done the same at every frame, which is where it really kind of bogs down the system.
It is kind of crazy to think about how sophisticated we are getting just to basically make it easier to zap aliens in space. And I don't mean to dismiss it, because I think gaming is important and I think gaming is fun, but the level of sophisticated technology they're doing basically just so this chunk of the screen your eyeball is following, I don't know, it's kind of crazy to look at this and to see what's happening. I also got to say it's kind of crazy to see some of the refresh rates that we're seeing on gaming monitors, but we can talk more about that next week. But
yeah,
massive monitors, huge 144 frames per second and higher rendering rates. But the RTX 2060 looks like a winner. If you have a 1080p monitor, it sounds like you should probably wait to see what happens next, unless $350 is something you don't mind spending. AMD Vegas 7. I was all set to see desktop Ryzen parts being released and some loose details on the next generation AMD Vega cards. But this is if their numbers are legit, this is a huge step up from first generation Vega. And also a big sort of thumb of the nose to half the planet who manufactures chips, because they're running at 7 nanometers. They're running a 7 nanometer process for this.
Yeah. I was so ready for desktop that I was actually sitting at the airport making charts for desktop based on early like leaks and that sort of thing. Because I wasn't briefed on it. We'll talk more about that a little later, because I know a non-tech had like the inside scoop on some of the desktop that's coming up. But Vega 7 or Vega 2, you know, when we first saw the trademark of the image, that's where all the speculation started. It's like, is it 7? Is it Vega 2, VII? And whatever you choose to call it, it is absolutely the second generation Vega part. And one of the things that I found was, you know, fascinating about this, it wasn't very long ago that we had news of the JEDEC specification changing for high bandwidth memory 2, and up to 24 gigabytes denser stacks, still at the same bandwidth. And here comes this part with 16 gigabytes of the fast HBM2. with just crazy amounts of memory bandwidth available. And that's something that I believe it was Samsung that worked with them on the standard to get that kind of capacity, where we had previously not seen anything. I think 8 gigabytes might have been the limit with the previous generation. But and anybody who questions the price, at $699, it's probably a very, very expensive proposition to put 16 gigabytes of HBM2 in a product at this point.
Right.
But still, I mean, relative to the market, if it's putting up $700-ish gaming numbers, then that price totally makes sense. We have yet to see that. Right. February 7 is the launch. It's like just the specs we were shown are that it has 60 compute units, which translates into 3,840 stream processors, and the core clock is 1.8 gigahertz. I've already seen some discussion about, well, right, what if you put it on Liquid? Because we saw some Liquid versions of previous Vega cards, and absolutely, I would hope that there's the headroom to go faster with exotic cooling, but we'll see. I would love to see some early performance numbers.
Did you see it was, or feel it, because they were very heavy duty on comparing it to the previous generation Vega. They had a lot of their own internally generated benchmarks for that. Did it feel odd to you that they didn't compare it specifically to any NVIDIA cards, or does that seem like sort of a gracious, you know what our existing cards do in performance, you know how they compare to the existing NVIDIA parts, you know, figure out. They didn't seem to call out NVIDIA at all, and given how happy and cheerful they were with the third-gen Ryzen information to call out Intel specifically, did it seem a little odd that they were just kind of, we have a much faster card, it's awesome, look at our 7-nanometer, it's so much faster than our first-generation card, and never really kind of got anywhere near doing side-by-side or discussion of NVIDIA?
Well, there was definitely, it seemed almost as much focus on content creation as there was on gaming. And we know where their confidence is. We know that AMD is supremely confident in their processors at this point, because I don't know if I'm ready yet to say that it's kind of like the Athlon XP, Athlon 64 era, where they had such an advantage with like price performance and just fantastic lower cost parts for mainstream consumers and gamers. But now that, and of course they also have Threadripper, which is just a fantastic. The more cores, the better. I mean, and this product, I'm not sure. I mean, on one side, anyone who is in the like Mac ecosystem, like OpenCL, anyone who uses Radeon cards specifically for their compute, this is a more powerful solution. But for gamers, I think it will come down to not just preference, like brand loyalty, but performance. Right. And for them to compare it against previous generation parts makes sense for them. Like you said, maybe if they're not as confident about showcasing their card versus the competition at this point, which anytime you don't directly call them out, like you said, they're more than willing to call out Intel.
Right.
And so I will wait and see. I'm not going to make any hasty judgments here, but yeah, it kind of seems like they might be waiting, but it sounded like they had final clock speeds, unlike desktops. So if this is it, if this is 1.8 gigahertz, its final product, they know internally what it can do.
It was the closest thing. It's, you know, like, you know, one of the benchmarks is they're like 25% faster than Vega 1 on Fortnite. And I remember seeing, like, you know, they did a Capcom DMC5 demo, and then it was like, you know, versus RTX 2080, similar performance. And that was pretty much the closest they came to get really in depth, because I'm scrolling through my AMD keynote notes. Extremely excited about, you know, once they stopped pushing content creation, they did a huge segment. They were talking about, you know, esports and the number of viewers and how it's growing. And, you know, Sam Matthews from Fnatic came on. It was, you know, they literally, I should say, you know, they, AMD literally did a Steve Jobs kind of moment, a one more thing moment. And they brought out the crowd got really enthusiastic. So I was sitting in the back of the room videotaping, and it's like, you know, third gen AMD Ryzen desktop processors running 7-nanometer. You know, they showed it. They're like, this is early silicon. They were, I guess they're running Forza at 100 plus frames per second. You know, third gen Ryzen against Core i9-9900K with Cinebench. You know, they don't have final frequency. It's an early sample. But part of what was really interesting is, A, the architecture of the chip, which I'll leave to Sebastian so I don't mess it up. But looking at the, if these are legit, they're, you know, at when they were looking at the rendering for video files in Cinebench, the Intel part was consuming like 180 watts and the AMD part was consuming 133 watts. And they were discussing how moving to the 7-nanometer process had given them some really significant heat and performance advantages. And it was interesting to think of AMD as being the processor consuming less power, because I always think of AMD as being the processor that they start hot and they get hotter and then they're ridiculously hot, and that's just part of owning an AMD part. And you know, I've got an 1800X. You know, you'll pry from my cold dead fingers because I love rendering video on it so much. But it was very interesting because that was a, you know, they challenged the Core i9-9900K on content creation. They called out their power consumption. They very specifically, you know, stuck a thumb in Intel's eye over being on a 7-nanometer process. The triplet die is kind of fascinating, right? The biggest, yeah. If you look at the chip, the close-up on that, Dr. Sue held up, you know, that the bigger die, the bigger black blotch in the middle of the CPU, is that's the I.O., And that's handling passing bits between the Zen 2 engine and the rest of the system. You know, and they also called out that they were supporting PCI Express 4, which right. feels early, or are we looking at a whole nother generation of graphics cards based around PCI 4 in a year or two?
I mean, video obviously, but also storage, because you know, I think it was Faison who was showing storage that could hit four gigabytes a second. Whoa. And we're already at the limit pretty much of what PCI Gen 3 by 4 can do.
Right.
So that's an interesting aspect of it. But yeah, I mean, they were saying first to market with fourth generation PCI Express. The interesting thing, and I know Anantech had a pretty detailed exploration of this. They got their hands on a sample, and when they were briefed on it, they were taking pictures and they did these like digital measurements where they're looking at die size versus like chiplet right. size. And they think that it's very possible this sort of modular design could enable them to put additional CPU cores on this AM4 processor. So, I mean, initial rumors, some of the reports we saw were claiming that they were absolutely going to be doing 16 core AM4 desktop,
right.
which seems kind of crazy. I mean, we were talking about that last week, but this design, I mean, there's a lot of empty space there to do something with. So I'm very, very curious to see if perhaps, you know, just move that one chiplet up and just put another one down below it. And I don't know if thermal dissipation is a concern at all or what, but at 7-nanometer, definitely they seem to have that advantage, like you said on stage, where they were showing, you know, roughly identical results mm-hmm. with Intel and significantly lower power. So a combination of the move to a smaller process node and refinement of the architecture seems to have won them some definite performance gains that are... It's really exciting. I mean, as exciting as Ryzen was and then Threadripper was, and we had second-gen Ryzen, the concept of third-gen Ryzen that is at least 8 cores, 16 threads, and potentially right. hitting some pretty aggressive clocks at lower power, I mean, it just keeps on getting better. So for the consumer, competition is very fierce, and that's great because it's driving costs down. And
it's good for
we've
us.
Gone from yeah, we've gone from what would you have thought you'd spend in like 2016 on 8 cores, 16 threads at like 4 gigahertz? I mean,
I would have expected to, you know, spend like, you know, $1,000 to $1,500, and you know, like I said, when the 1800X came out, you know, I bought one out of pocket to benchmark. And there's this extraordinary performance. I would say, I feel like I paid almost $500 for it. A year later, it was before the next gen Ryzen 7 parts were out. You know, the price had dropped down to $350 for a level of performance that was almost 50% faster than the top of the line Intel part I'd been running that was, you know, I guess a year, maybe not even a year and a half old at that point. It's funny, we haven't talked too much about Intel, but it was really interesting to sit in the Intel keynote and have them talk about processors up front and early and enthusiast processors, or at least, you know, mainstream processors and their high performance processors, you know, at the top and sounding like they act, well, you know, we're Intel. We actually do care about desktops and enthusiast markets, and you're not an afterthought anymore. And oh my goodness, you know, we're going to do like a hexa-core part as a Core i5 part instead of making you spend, you know, a significant more amount of money to get that kind. It's, you know, AMD is absolutely forcing Intel to, you know, catch up and to drop prices and to pay attention and to be competitive. And I think this is awesome.
Yeah. I mean, it's like history repeating itself, but it's that era was when I got started as a PC mm-hmm. enthusiast. And to see this again, where Intel has gone from having such an incredible lead where it almost seemed in the bulldozer era like AMD might never catch up.
Yeah, to or the point AMD where might now, flat out disappear.
Right, yeah. That was another concern. And, you know, even among people in the community who really care about AMD and were rooting for AMD, like they were concerned. And mm-hmm. then to see this where they have come back into such a position where they are forcing Intel's hand, forcing prices down, and forcing core counts up, like you said. Core i5 at 6 cores, and looking mm-hmm. at parts, like even at the entry level, I know the one new Core i5 part they announced was, I believe, the 9400 series, and that's hex core. And I haven't seen pricing yet, but like the 8400 series, 7400, those are like your $189, $200 parts in a mm-hmm. box with a cooler. So That's pretty inexpensive for hex core. And then of course right now on the market, AMD is selling their hex core parts, their Ryzen Gen 2 2000 series, like $165 for the 2600. So they've definitely upped the competition to the degree that they are kind of a driving force in not only Intel's adoption of these higher core counts, but in forcing their prices down, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
Although prices are still, AMD seems to still have the lead in pricing. So
that's okay.
Yeah. That's, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that.
You know, and that'll also force Intel, if the sales aren't what Intel expects, maybe they'll actually force them to think about their traditional margins and whether or not those are viable in this particular market. Or they'll be like, yeah, you know, there's still a moat, a tiny percentage of our overall processor sales. And that would be a reasonable response. Like, they have 10% of the market. They have 13% of the market. Most people, right, still buy laptops. The majority of consumers buy laptops these days. The majority of businesses buy laptops these days. And that was really interesting to me, was that Sunday morning, before CES really opened, AMD dropped a whole family of mobile CPUs. You know, the kind of top of the line AMD Ryzen 7 3750H, it's a 35-watt performance part, the 3700U, it's a 15-watt 4-core 8-thread. Those are actually both 4-core 8-thread CPUs, 2.3 gigahertz base, 4 gigahertz and turbo, packing Vega 10 graphics, i.e. 10 Vega compute units. The Ryzen 5 is basically the H parts are 35 watts, the U parts are 15 watts, and I'll stop talking about wattages. you know,
hey, you know, again, wattages matter for notebook.
Absolutely, but there's only so many times people can hear me say 35 watt and 15 watt back to back before they start throwing things at their computer or their phone. But, you know, again, 4-core, 8-thread parts at the Ryzen 5 level, but with 8 GPU core parts and running at, you know, 3.7 gigahertz max. Ryzen 3, I thought this was fascinating. They have two parts, and one of them is a 4-core, 4-thread part with either 6 or 3 GPU cores, running at a max at 3.5 gigahertz in turbo mode. And I was I was really impressed. That's aggressive. And if these parts are as power efficient as I think Ryzen Mobile parts can be, this is going to be interesting to watch Intel deal with, because the idea of having, you know, a Core i3, a Ryzen 3 part that is offering that many cores is going to offer a pretty noticeable performance advantage, I think, in general computing, especially at the price points parts like that usually tend to show up on.
Yeah, we're used to seeing premium laptops on the Intel side that are quad core or dual core hyper threaded parts. So to see, you know, 8 threaded parts at what I can only imagine will be a competitive price to the laptop manufacturers to implement is interesting. I know one of the things that I saw at the show at Asus was a all AMD gaming laptop series where they have the processor, they have discrete graphics from their RX series. But I think, like you were saying, even for productivity, you're taking like a mobile workstation or just general productivity device with you.
Right.
As long as it's power gating aggressively and you have a really good longevity, a 35 watt part is considered kind of like your high end typically even now, but 15 watts, especially those, the 3500U, the 3300U, we could see those in some smaller form factors perhaps, mm-hmm. and sort of a similar thing to what you can currently find on the market with those ubiquitous Core i5 thin and light laptops. So definitely interesting, and especially because you have the integration of the Vega graphics cores. So, you know, the laptop I took to CES, it's like the generic laptop of today where it's some sort of Core i5 processor. This one's Coffee Lake. It's got like the MX series GPU from NVIDIA in it. And it's marketed as a productivity device. It's like a thin and light business laptop, essentially.
Right.
But this opens up some interesting possibilities for sure.
One of the claims AMD made when they announced the mobile parts was that those onboard Vega graphics were going to give you a pretty significant bump in frame rates on video games compared to, say, a Core i7 8565U. And never having run Fortnite or Rocket League on that part, I now want to fire up a Rocket League or Fortnite on a Core i7 and just so I can see what the real frame rates on that. But, well, okay. Well, let me qualify that. They were talking about 60 frames per second.
No, I mean, yeah, in the interest of science. Oh, okay. All right. So with modest detail settings at lower resolutions. Okay. I mean, I don't want you to do that to yourself, but
no.
At the same time, it's a valuable information. It's a good data point to have.
But it was funny because I have not bothered to, you know, except for sort of, you know, whatever the PC equivalent of Lumini Town, you know what I mean? Like, I play simple phone level games on my laptops most of the time because I don't have a discrete GPU in my laptop. But the idea of being able to play like Rocket League at 60 frames per second, that's kind of compelling, but it also makes me want to know exactly what the frame rates that are coming out of the Intel parts, if they're comparing them to. Let me be clear. We're not talking about 1080p. We're not talking about probably even medium detail. You're talking probably fairly low resolution, fairly low settings. You know, you are going to want a discrete chipset of some type if you are going to do mobile gaming, which, by the way, they announced the mobile. NVIDIA announced the mobile versions of, I want to say, the 2080, the 2070, and the 2060. So it's I think we figured out there were, I think they said there were 40 NVIDIA, mobile NVIDIA RTX powered gaming laptops that were announced just at this show. So it's not a bad time to be buying a gaming laptop.
No. And then one more quick point on Ryzen Mobile. I was just thinking about, don't forget the whole mini PC space. Well, yeah, that too. But I've been looking at mini PCs for years, and one of the arguments was always like, "Oh, I wish we could put an APU in this. I wish there was an APU from the commenters, from the readers." And this is a great opportunity for that too, because you get one of these lower powered parts that can fit in one of those really small form factors, or even a fanless solution, and you have significantly more graphics horsepower than you would in any of the current Intel integrated solutions. So that's an interesting possibility as well.
And a delightful one. I have to call this out before I talk about this particular laptop. Tech Things coverage of CES 2019 was sponsored by Dell. However, over the years, Ryan and I have discussed, I think, in detail, and I've certainly made first humorous and then really obnoxious comments over the years about the one great flaw of the Dell XPS 13, which is the nostril cam. And if you don't remember me talking about the nostril cam, it's the fact that
they were
so obsessed with the Infinity bezels, the incredibly thin bezels, which I got to say look fantastic. And we'll talk about some Lenovo laptops that are moving in that direction next week. But they would always have the webcam down here. So it was always looking up here. And you would sort of end up with this, you know, kind of angle on things, which is not only unattractive, but makes it difficult to communicate. Or you stared at the down corner of your laptop. It's irritating. I'll just leave it
at
that.
Dell really missed the boat there, because they could have been the first to market with a notch. Think about it. It could have been the Dell XPS 13 with a notch right in the middle of the screen at the top.
I was actually laughing because my co-host on Tech Thing, Shannon, tweeted out, Patrick is going to be so excited.
Yes, I saw that.
I was just like, you know, and I literally went in and fondled the laptop in question over in the Dell display over here. And I got some, it was really interesting because they showed the old webcam module and the new webcam module. And you're talking about the new one is like 2.25 millimeters down from 7 millimeters. So they made a huge reduction in the size of the part, and then they also there across the top they made a slightly larger bezel. So they did something we in the married and parenting industries like to call compromises, or a compromise, and they left enough room at the top of the laptop to actually put a webcam, a very tiny webcam, and probably not the best in terms of low light performance. But the reality is most people don't do business conferencing or Skyping home to their children in the dark. They usually do it in fairly bright environments. And it's a Dell XPS 13. It types well, it looks good. You know, they're going to be doing with this next one, the 9380. It's 8th gen Core i3, Core i5, or Core i7 parts. 4 gigabytes to 16 gigabytes. The entry price is $899, which I need to double check, but I believe that's a 4 gigabyte laptop. Don't buy a 4 gigabyte laptop. You'll be frustrated if you do. You know, if they've got 1920x1080, 1920x1080 touchscreen, or a 3840x2160 pixel touchscreen, which is the predecessor to this. I have spent hundreds, if not thousands, of hours on that laptop. And it's well made. 128 gigabyte to 2 terabyte storage options. And those are basically, they started shipping 2 days ago. And let me just double check to see what the lowest end configuration of the 9380 is. $899, 4 gigabytes, 128 gigabyte of M.2 NVMe, but 128 gigabytes. If you can scrape up the money to step up to 8 gigabytes of RAM, please do so.
As a public service message from Patrick Norton.
Sorry, I had a cousin that bought a laptop and it was cheap and he found out why. I would say that $1,200 configuration with 8 gigs and 256 gigabytes of M.2 drive would be a really good start on that. And, you know, they're nice laptops. And again, in case you didn't hear me say it before, my coverage of Dell sponsored our coverage at Tech Thing of CES 2019, but this is also a laptop I've been carrying and abusing and testing forever. And I'm just really delighted that they will no longer be forcing the pain of nostril cam on their users. Not that that's really bothered the snot out of me for a few years.
You know, I don't think that viewers really can appreciate, if they're watching, how like you tried to recreate it. It's almost impossible to recreate without lowering your webcam down to the keyboard level and pointing it up at the bottom of your face.
It
was pretty extreme.
It's a distinctly unpleasant view of almost every human being I've ever seen on it. Speaking of unpleasant and irritating, I was also laughing on Twitter about this. It's a tradition. When 4G started rolling out, my antiquated iPhone at the time, which was a 4 or a 6, I guess a 4, magically received an upgrade. And in the top corner, and if you, I don't know if you've got the Verge article on this, Jacob Kostomakis with this one up. If you, I don't know if we can zoom in on that at the mothership in Petaluma, but that there it is. You, Kevin, you're so wonderful. It says 5G. And I had a 3G phone that was always going to be a 3G phone because it only had 3G radios in it. And magically, one day, it became a 4G phone. Well, it didn't. Yeah. It just changed the, you know, display. So it would display 4G, which I still to this day don't understand, because wouldn't you want your customers to go buy a new phone that you would finance for 2 years and make all sorts of money off of? But this is, you know... This is just dumb. I don't know how else to say it.
Well, I remember back in the area that you're talking about when AT&T had the enhanced backhaul HSPA Plus, and I don't know. Was that a permanent thing? Was the 4G icon a permanent thing? Because I guess I was on other devices when I was playing around with that, and I was getting the HS, like the Plus logo when I was connected to a 3G network, even if it wasn't LTE. Like,
you know, it's kind of like being called a particularly obscene name by someone. You know, unless it's really part of your relationship, you always remember that and are irritated about it. And as soon as I saw this, all of the irritation, you know, of seeing that logo show up, I'm like, oh, it's 5G Evolution.
You know, true to my commitment to bring up projectors every single week, this is like the 4K projector thing where it's like 4K enhanced.
Right.
And it's really not 4K, but it's enhanced so it can like simulate 4K. This is like simulating some of the advantages of being on a next gen network without actually being on the next gen network.
Right. I will say the Epson 4010, which does pixel shifting, or FAUX, F-A-U-X-K, looks absolutely stunning and gorgeous, even if it doesn't have true 4K projection. But it's so odd, you know. I don't know why AT&T does this, you know. They're basically branding parts of their existing 4G LTE network as 5G Evolution. You know, in theory, they're going to be faster than LTE, except it's all the same crap that, you know, all this is set really more by the tower than the phones, and all the carriers have done this. It's not 5G, although 5G is a hot mess for a thousand interesting reasons, some of which I can't actually discuss on camera.
Well, one of the things about 5G is, like, with the validation of the standard as to what it actually is, there were so many different ideas about what 5G could be at one point, whether it was like blanketing Wi-Fi throughout an environment, or combinations of different technologies working together, like microcell. And if they are providing, and I haven't read the technical details of what exactly AT&T is doing, if they're sharing that, but if they are doing some sort of aggregation where you're legitimately getting more bandwidth than you would on a traditional 4G network, then like the traditional LTE network,
right?
And that could be interesting. I know there could be some technical advantages, but essentially this, I mean, let's face it, this is marketing. And while people like you and I and technically literate people will instantly point to this and question it and even laugh at it, the average consumer who goes into one of the operator stores, like AT&T stores, looking for a new phone, they're seeing advertising that says, oh yeah, this phone will do 5G. And they're looking at basically a branding for areas where AT&T may not support 5G, but now they can claim that they do. So this is, I wonder if they'll face any kind of sanctions about this as far as their national advertising goes, because it seems a little questionable to say that you're selling a 5G product when you don't actually have 5G towers to back it up in the areas where you're selling it. So that's, I'd be very cautious about this if I were them.
I don't know. It's just it's unnecessary and it's irritating, and it really has become kind of sort of a perverse tradition for this to happen.
It's like my tradition of leaving my cell phone in a cab at, I think it's the Sands. Like, I mean, we all have traditions that are not good traditions, But, you know, life moves on.
It does. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by OnDeck. OnDeck is 100% committed to small business owners with fast, easy, and tailored financing. Your time is valuable. You don't want to be sitting in a room locked up, driving to strange locations to get money for your business. OnDeck, they know your time is valuable. They get you funding in as fast as 24 hours with term loans up to $500,000, lines of credit up to $100,000, none of which require business collateral. The application process, it's simple. You can apply online or by phone. You can approve the minutes. It's not something where you're going to be driving somewhere and meeting with somebody and filling out paperwork and just suffering. Best of all, it won't impact your personal credit because it's a business loan, not a personal loan. OnDeck delivers some of the best customer service with their U.S.-based loan specialists and has an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau. It's nice to see an A-plus rating, and I don't think I get to see those very often. So, you know, this is trustworthy. They've lent over $10 billion to over 80,000 small business owners. OnDeck is the secure financing service that business owners everywhere can truly rely on. If you're a small business owner and need access to capital, go to ondeck.com/twitch right now. And as a listener of This Week in Computer Hardware, you'll receive a free consultation with one of their U.S.-based loan specialists. Apply online or by phone and get approved in minutes. Go to ondeck.com/twitch. That's ondeck.com/TWICH for your free consultation now. And we want to thank OnDeck for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. Oh my goodness. Asus's ProArt PA32 UCX monitor, 1200 nits and 1000 zone backlight.
You know,
that's staggering.
Yeah, I started on one side of Asus, and they were, I don't know if you visited them, but they were in multiple suites. By the time I got to their like professional and like content creator suite where I saw this monitor, I was blown away by 512 zones in one of the gaming monitors. And then I saw this, and I just stood there kind of with my mouth open for a while, just watching this beautiful 4K footage they had of like scenery and like trees and beaches and things. And there is a depth to, there's a kind of magic to really, really good full array local dimming when it has this many zones that it's different from OLED. And I have an OLED television, but it's a different kind of a thing. Like it's, and this has the capability of far exceeding the HDR 1000 spec. In the color depth and as well as the backlight, and the 1200 nit peak brightness is pretty staggering, especially on this 32 inch display. Yeah. But you know, companies using these very small LED, individual LED lights directly behind the screen, which actually reminded me a lot of the like LG Infinia stuff from way back in like 2009, 2010. And that was what I was lamenting the death of the full array local dimming system when edge lighting kind of took over, and it was like the race to who could have the thinnest television. And it was basically considered too expensive because consumers didn't really understand what the benefit was. And the TVs were a little bit thicker when you have a direct backlighting system. So, but HDR has brought it back. I have HDR to thank for restoring my absolute favorite display technology. And I've seen displays that look pretty good that were limited to maybe a dozen zones where you can at least control like corner lighting and things and dim sections of the screen. But this was, it feels almost like it's pinpoint control over the light when you have that many zones. And 1,000 zones on a 32-inch screen is huge.
Let me put this into context for a second. You know, I think it was Vizio had a couple of years ago, Robert and I thought that, you know, basically you can light a monitor from the edge or you can put, you know, LEDs behind it. And to have the more zones you have, more granular the control you have, right? That's what's part of what's different and what the advantage of OLED is, because you can control individual pixels. So I was going to say, there's the new Vizio, I want to say, is a 65-inch television with 480 zones. And I was absolutely blown away with the idea of a television that big with 480 zones. So we're talking more than twice as many zones in a television, or excuse me, a monitor that's about a quarter of the size of that. So this is an astonishing amount of light control for a screen this size. I mean, moving in this direction, Hisense had an interesting, Robert was talking about this, we were talking about some of the best televisions that came out at CES this year. And Robert was talking about an experiment at Hisense that there were actually engineers from other television companies openly coming up with measuring instruments to test and take pictures, and just, and the Hisense people were apparently just sitting there kind of beaming. And what they did was they took a 1080p panel and laminated it to a 4K panel, a 4K HDR panel, and used the 1080p LCD as the backlighting. So there was one LCD pixel from the 1080p panel to light up each of the, or four pixels of each of the 4K panel in front of it. And it's kind of a wild concept, but it's, again, it's not OLED, it's not individual pixel control, but it's, you know, 2,073,600 discrete zones for a 4K monitor, which is ridiculous and amazing, and I don't know if it's ever going to ship. But to have that level of, one, that amount of brightness, which is pretty staggering, and two, you know, I mean, that's did they have like a basic HDR 1000 rating, or were they just kind of, you know, it's brighter than anything we've seen in this size. That level of backlighting gives an extraordinary control over how the monitor looks. I mean, I want to go find it now because I'm fascinated.
Yeah, it does have the VESA 1000. They said they exceeded the spec. The spec, I think, was actually shown, like the logo. But yeah, I mean, you do have to see it, because it, you can only sort of try to think about what that many zones would look like on that small of a screen. But like you're saying, I mean, the more pinpoint light control you have, and it's reminds me of what Sony did with their Z9 TV. I think that was a couple of years ago now when that was introduced.
Right.
Where you just have an insane amount of light. Basically, they have a low resolution display made of just white light behind the LCD. And right. The two are creating the same image at the same time. And the lower resolution image is providing the luminance. And essentially at that point, the LCD is just doing chroma, mm-hmm. because it is just filtering light. And the result is just staggering.
Right.
And it's, I hesitate to, I mean, I don't know the retail pricing, and I'm sure it's probably going to be up there because it's a professional monitor. Let's face it. It's a pro art monitor, and it just, the amount of money that probably went into R&D.
Right. It would not be unusual for a monitor like this to be $4,000 to $6,000, especially depending on the level of sophistication and the calibration.
Yes, exactly. And for them to be targeting, like, photographers and videographers, then I don't think that it's a price that, especially if you're creating HD content, like HDR content, I should say, like this is, you know, close to that professional display where it can do 1000 plus brightness, and you have that kind of color accuracy and black level control. So
it's pretty interesting to look at. Man, I you know, micro LEDs, you know, they're showing up all over CES this year behind back panels, in products from places like Corsair and other places. It's a very tiny, you know, it looks like it looks like somebody, imagine sort of staring at a screen door really closely, or the pixels on your screen, and, you know, having several hundred LEDs packed into a square inch, and you kind of get the idea of what's going on here. It gives them a lot of brightness, very different package. A lot of granular control. I think it's going to be interesting to see where this technology shows up and how it influences things moving forward. So I want to give a shout out to SanDisk Extreme Pro Portable. SanDisk came out with the Extreme, which is a small portable drive, which looks a lot like this, but is a little bit smaller in all plastic. There's a aluminum frame. You can kind of see the sort of the red bits poking out of there. And SanDisk wants to point out that they don't want you to put this on your backpack with a carabiner. They have that that little loop there. You can scroll down and show it on there. They want it inside your backpack. It's IP55 rated, so it's fairly splash proof. It's fairly dust proof. You know, they test it to 6-foot drops. But that loop on there is for a dummy cord to keep it attached inside your backpack. But they've taken the original one. They put aluminum in there to make it more rigid, but mostly to dissipate heat, because it's now an NVMe drive. instead of a regular SSD. And the performance numbers they were talking about is they're flat out saying reads at a gigabyte a second. I'm kind of curious to get my grubby little paws on one and see what the write speeds are. But available in 2 terabyte, 1 terabyte, and 500 gigabyte versions. And those will be selling soon. And if you know,
these are ready to go.
I got
my hands on them at Western Digital, and they're really focused on trying to really saturate like the PCIe 3.1 bus as the current generation bus as far as they'll go. Like you said, gigabit per second, or gigabyte per second, I should say. So, I am excited about faster storage. That's for sure.
Yeah, I didn't know that the My Passport Go existed, and which is their less expensive consumer-oriented SSD, which is basically smaller than a Passport drive, has a USB cable built into it, so it's easier to store. It's not as you're not going to want to splash it in the water or play with it at the beach. But I was kind of excited to realize that there were portable SSDs at those price points from Western Digital. The My Passport Go, I want to say it starts at like $89 for a 500 gigabyte version. There it is. It looks, you don't realize how tiny it is until you actually have it in your hand. It's $89.99 for the 500 gigabyte version. The 1 terabyte version is $170, which is kind of puts it on parity with the original Extreme Drive from SanDisk. And as I save up my pennies, I'm going to be replacing as many of the rotating media portable drives in my life with solid state drives, just to have that much less to worry about as I'm bouncing my backpack through the strange and terrible locales here at CES.
It's kind of like somewhere in between thumb drives and hard drives. We now have these, like, they're half the size of a portable SSD. They're bigger than a thumb drive, but they have tons of storage capacity. And you know the other advantage of? I was just thinking of they're harder to lose. Yeah. I'm a little scared of buying really high capacity thumb drives at the alarming rate that I tend to lose them. And they'll randomly show up months later sometimes, but that doesn't really help me in the short term. So
why is this in the cat's bed? Well, were you excited? Because the other thing they announced that I really didn't expect to see was SanDisk Flashback, which it's not going to be on older, but I don't have the laptop in. Wait, hold on. I have a laptop in here, and they have 128 gigabyte and 256 gigabyte versions of these. And I love these things because when I first bought one of these, it was as large as the SSD inside of the laptop, and I could just plug it into the. I've been running one for about 2 years, 2.5 years now. There are moments of total, undeniable, abject terror because the little tiny thing the size of a nickel is somewhere in the hotel room, or, you know, that's why you kind of, you know, put it in the USB port, never put it back. In fact, I'm forcing myself to put it in the USB port right now, which is causing someone at the table opposite me to look at me with what probably resembles mild terror because they can't see what my hands are doing below the table. So I'll just pull this up like this. Wave and they'll turn away, and they just did. That was really funny. So they came up with SanDisk Flashback. It's really simple, right? It's automated cloud backup. They're going to do it with the Ultra USB 3.1 and the Ultra Fit USB 3.1 flash drives. And you have to buy the new ones because they need a particular identifying number encoded onto the drive itself to unlock the service. But it automatically backs up your thumb drive to their cloud storage system constantly. So that's cool. You know, you label your drives. It tells you, you know, you can click on, I left that drive at home. Well, you can access it online. I think I lost that drive. Well, you can access it online. I can't remember which drive has the baby photos on it or the presentation or my homework or the picture of the cat. You can search the contents of all of your Flashback ready drives that you've backed up online. And it's fairly cheap. First year is free. After that, it's $1 a year for the 16 gigabyte drive, maxing out, I think, $10 a year for the 256 gigabyte drive. You have to make sure there's a little sort of sticker in the corner that tells you that it is the appropriate drive that has the certification number, but they're out in stores now. I mean, you know, this is this is something that is pretty much pointed at you.
Yeah, it's a great way of kind of forcing people to have that cloud backup.
Right.
And I thought it was interesting that, you know, it makes sense for them to be kind of giving you a taste of the online storage, because eventually they will charge you for it after the first year, but the prices are low. Like compared to industry average, there was pretty aggressive pricing. And they're giving you the same amount of storage like as the drive itself. So if you buy a 256 gig drive, you get that amount of online storage for free for the first year. And then after that, you pay monthly or yearly for it.
Nothing wrong with that. What was going on with something we don't generally expect to see very often these days, our new sound cards. What was going on with EVGA? Right.
So when I walked into EVGA and then when I thought I was at a hi-fi show, this suddenly made me very happy, because here we have like an engineer from the UK setting up this really nice sound system. And what this is, and I was a little surprised, because we had seen like on Twitter, EVGA had teased this new product coming, and it kind of looked like the corner of a video card. And instead, it's like, it looks like a miniature video card. It even has RGB lighting on it. But it is a sound card. It's called the New Audio Card.
Right.
And it's not just a sound card. This is like specifically geared towards audio enthusiasts. And it's first and foremost a stereo card. This is not like your typical gaming solution where it's a DSP creating simulated like 3D effects and that sort of thing.
It's similar to the Asus Zonar cards that came out several years ago, where they sat down and decided to create a PCI Express card that was a badass stereo source.
Yes. And by the numbers that they had internally, and I'd love to have this stuff to put together in like a review, but some of their internal testing showed very, very impressive signal-to-noise ratio, channel separation, extremely low intermodulation distortion and just distortion numbers in general. And you were looking at something that looked like, if you read stereophile reviews, we were seeing this kind of material in the suite, and like, this is like a legitimate audiophile. This looks like a DAC. Yeah. And it has a PCI Express package.
One of my favorite DACs is actually on that, AKM AK4493. I love AKM's DACs. I have two of them at home, built in the JDS Labs products. You know, the specs look fantastic. They did, there's capacitor prawn.
Exactly. I know. I had to put that in our post too, because I'm like, they took the trouble of doing this, and you don't often see the component quality in a sound card. And the big thing I wanted to point out too is Asus did this before, and it's really good to see another product that actually has dedicated clock chips, like oscillators for the different actual sampling rates. So you have a 44.1 based and a 48 kilohertz based clock generator. So you're getting legitimate 44.1 16-bit, like every CD ever made and almost every MP3 file and music that streams over the internet is 1644. And yet almost every computer in the world has only the 48 kilohertz clock generator. So everything you're hearing gets resampled on the fly, and not usually very well. So it's good to see another solution that actually is you're giving you the sound in an unaltered state. And they were playing uncompressed music files through kind of an entry-level hi-fi system, like a $2,000 integrated amplifier and speakers to match. And it sounded fantastic, even in a hotel suite. But I got to demo with headphones as well. It sounds really, really clean. And I just personally was geeking out over two-channel audio, really? And especially from EVGA, I'm thinking this is a gaming company, this is a graphics card company, but hey, they are audio enthusiasts. I was very pleased to see the founder of the company was showing off pictures of his home, like stereo rig, and
that's funny.
He's all about the two channel audio. So, and the price tag, puts this in kind of an interesting position, though, because I don't think a lot of people in the mainstream are interested in an audio card, period, because they are probably content with motherboard audio, because they've never really heard the difference. And then higher-end audio solutions somewhere in the $99 and above range are, you know, they're out of a lot of people's, they're off their radar a little. And this is $249.
Right.
So it's definitely a high-end product, and it's an audiophile product. Mm-hmm. But it's sometimes hard for me, especially because I've been trying to do this for years, convince people to spend more money on good two-channel audio. And I hope it's successful. It really just takes a demo to hear a difference.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's impressive in a lot of ways, but also it's competing against products that sell for, you know, like a, I want to say like JDS Labs, their OL DAC sells for $100, you know, which is, it doesn't have a headphone amplifier built into it, but you can get like the OL DAC and their Atom headphone amplifier for $200, which are discrete and external, but it's, I don't know. It's always tough to be in a world where you've got something like an AudioQuest Dragonfly, where for $130, $150, you can get some pretty extraordinary sound output. And it's also funny because I stepped into Audio Precision's suite to find a contact there because of having so many questions about how people are interpreting. Because, you know, we don't really do them here because, you know, I don't own a, you know, $20,000 audio analyzer, and nor am I very likely to. But it's interesting to see the way certain groups online kind of battle over interpreting the stats on that. So I basically tracked down some of the engineers so I could start asking them questions about how people are interpreting the numbers and what's considered audible or not. And it's like, you know, I think a negative 130 dB is kind of well below the audible threshold in an instrument or, you know, in a piece of audio equipment. And why are people getting so upset about that? And there may or may not have been some, it's interesting to look at. I'm fascinated that they did this. I'm curious to see what the MSRP is going to, or I should say what the street price is going to be versus the MSRP.
Yeah. And there's already early pricing for members of their, they have like a insider program, and that will be offered to those members at, I think, $189. So already looking at the possibility of perhaps a lower price going forward, I would not be surprised at all. And one of the interesting things about this, actually, architecturally, I don't know if that's the right word, internally, it's actually a USB device. So it's a USB device bridged to a PCIe interface. And I immediately asked the engineer from AudioNote who was there.
Right.
And he's like, I said, so will there be a USB version of this? And he kind of was like, yeah, that's kind of in the works. That was the sort of thinking. And no promises on any products or anything, but this is kind of like an introduction to sound from EVGA. It's sort of an aspirational product, I think, for somebody to get into high-end audio. And one of the ideas behind it is that because it is PCIe, you can put this into a small form factor build and then have something you could take with you that has like studio quality sound capability without having to worry about bringing an external solution. So for people like us, it's interesting.
I don't know. It was also like I got a chance to listen to some speakers. There's some new fantastically priced, first of all, like air motion transformers, which is a peculiar kind of tweeter that looks like the side of an accordion, and it's pleated and it goes like this. And a company called Heil invented them. They were showing up all over the place. ELAC, Andrew Jones from ELAC, and I won't put everybody to sleep by going, ELAC makes great stuff for an amazing price, because you've heard me do that 1,000 times. I just did it again. Sorry. Andrew Jones designed his first air motion transformer, although it's the jet tweeter they have that comes out of a tradition at ELAC. And there was another, you know, there's a new, I want to say the T0 from Emotiva, which sounds unbelievably good for the money you're paying for that from air motion transformers. There was a couple other companies out there. It was interesting to see so many of these show up at CES this year. I feel comfortable almost in calling it a trend. for CES.
Don't jinx it.
So yeah, I won't jinx it. I'm just excited. I'm always excited. You know, we're not going to touch anything in headphones or headsets today. We'll maybe do that next week. But
some interesting things there for sure to cover, yeah.
Yeah, and some frustrating things too, especially in gaming headsets. But I'm always bitter about some of the gaming, some of the choices made in gaming headsets. I'll save it for next week. But it's I always love it when high quality audio stuff shows up because I love music. And also, maybe I'll point out that most gaming is actually designed for stereo reproduction, and that maybe using third-party tools to create, you know, 3D sound experiences might not work particularly well on many video games. But we can talk about that next week.
Yeah.
Because again, there's just a ton of stuff at CES every year. All right, you know, I forgot that this was the next story on here. HyperX and Odyssey team up for a new headset.
Yeah, see, speaking of gaming headsets.
Yeah.
But this is interesting because it's planar magnetic.
Yes.
Odyssey 100 millimeter drivers.
Yeah, well, it's basically HyperX's version of the Odyssey Mobius headset, yes. which I have spent a lot of time with.
And I believe the retail on that one is about $100 more than this, right? This is $299 from HyperX. Well, so it's at the very high end of like the gaming headset market, but the low end of the planar magnetic like Odyssey market.
It's the low end of Odyssey. I like a lot of what Odyssey does. They are not an inexpensive company.
No.
You know, they make a lot of, you know, they make $3,000 headphones. They make no apologies about it. And quite frankly, for some of their products, I wouldn't apologize either because they're that good. And they're up there at, you know, Odyssey, Mr. Speakers, some of the high-end versions of the Fostech stuff. Hi-Fi Man would be another one where, you know, anywhere from, you know, I mean, the very best planar magnetics are probably starting at around $300. And planar magnetics, do you want to talk about planar magnetics? Because I'm going to pull up a link real quick, but
no,
it's a very different way of pushing sound into your ear holes.
The closest parallel that I have here, because I don't have any planar headphones, is I have planar speakers. I have a pair of MagnaPan MT12s, which are a few years old now. But this is a large, it's almost like a window frame. You have something that's about 4 feet tall. This one's about a foot and a half wide and an inch thick. The idea behind these is you have a very thin film. And MagnaPan is a little bit different because they still have a coil. But essentially, you have something that is suspended between two magnets, and electrical, like positive and negative charges, can pull this film, this extremely lightweight film, backwards and forwards at incredible rates of speed, and do things that traditional speaker coils just cannot do. Where you worry about rigidity with speaker coils, which, you know, if you're not rigid enough, then you have distortion through different parts of the audio spectrum. But if you are too thick in the name of becoming more rigid, then you lose out on the ability to move the speaker efficiently enough to reproduce the sound at higher frequencies. So it's really a fantastic alternative. The problem is that historically it's been so expensive to implement. Yes. And it was unheard of in mainstream headphones, and there are even planar magnetic earbuds now from Odyssey, but that's sort of subject for another day.
Yeah, I mean, Odyssey, they've done more to push planar magnetic technology into different places than any other company out there in terms of the iSign, which is a very small, or the Sign, which is a very small over-ear, or so on-ear planar magnetic headphone. The iSigns, which are the in-ears, the earbuds you were talking about. But they, you know, when you look at planar magnetic technology, the only stuff under $200 used to be Fostech's T50 RPs, which sound extraordinary, but they kind of disappear below 60 hertz, which sucks if you're dealing with explosions or you like have full round bass drum setting. You know, they do an extraordinary job rendering, because, you know, Sebastian was explaining, when you take something that's like a sophisticated version of Saran wrap and run electricity through it while suspending it between two stators, you can accelerate and decelerate it incredibly fast, which gives you extraordinary resolution or the detail. You know, cymbals sound best when the decay or the you know, backside of the sound is rendered more accurately, and being able to precisely control that driver is really amazing. But, you know, right now you can get Hi-Fi Man's HE400Is for about $180. Monolith's early planar magnetics were, I will affectionately say, kind of atrocious, but you can get their closed back, the M565C, which sounds pretty amazing. And in fact, a friend of mine over at the Wirecutter, Laura Dragan, picked that as the kind of the best everyday audiophile headphones. They sell for $230 right now. They do not have a mic, so they may not be appropriate if you need to get your Discord on, or you would have to use a separate mic, but the audio experience is kind of really extraordinary. And by the way, feel free to, you know, buy things through the Wirecutter, because clicking on those Amazon links is how they get paid. But there was a lot of stuff going on that I haven't had a chance to go up to HyperX's suite yet. You know, I loved the drivers in the Odyssey Mobius. They felt comfortable. You know, it's an incredibly flexible, you know, plastic, okay, we're going to deal with gamers flinging stuff, you know, across the room, and it's not going to break. My frustration was with, and I believe, I know for a fact, they either have released or are working on a firmware upgrade, because the microphone configuration made its, it was kind of cutting off communications, making it more difficult, which I believe is something you fix in firmware. But I will be flat out, I don't particularly enjoy the Waves NX audio environments above and beyond, say, you know, consuming content where it creates sort of a 5.1 surround. I don't particularly like the artificial kind of impacts they bring to game, or the artificial rooming, or the artificial, you know, room simulation or environment simulation they bring to games. Some people have found that it actually creates issues with how it reinterprets the soundtrack for the games, because the games are designed to come from two speakers or 5.1 speakers. And in some cases it was kind of, I think a friend of mine said the way he explained it was like, he thought somebody was stalking him, you know, right next to him, like somebody was about to stab him in the video game, you know, and he kind of stood up and turned to defend himself. And in the video game environment, they were, you know, hundreds of yards away and then sniped him. And, you know, I loved the sound of the Mobius, and, you know, the Bluetooth was really, really effective. Conversing on the microphone was problematic, but again, that seems to be a firmware repair. But I would have so much preferred that it was a straight stereo headset rather than including all the Waves NX technology. Because the other thing is, as a content creator, the head tracking stuff that costs more in the HyperX headset is great if you are, you know, if you are creating an object-oriented sound environment and you want to simulate that, it's great. But head tracking, I don't particularly need to leave my audio here and hear it in my left ear when I'm playing most video games, because I'm never leaving my face from the video game, because I'm playing a video game and I don't want to get shot or stabbed or run off the track or, you know, not catch a pass or whatever. You know what I mean? You don't. And for VR headsets, the VR headset does all of the tracking, so you don't need a secondary device tracking the motion because your headset's already doing that. So I was very curious to see this partnership between HyperX and Mobius, and the fact that I was kind of like, oh, it's, you know, the other thing we should probably point out is the most sophisticated stuff using the 3D, the Waves NX technology requires you to be plugged into the computer via a USB cable.
That's true. One thing I should have clarified in the news post is that there are two versions, one with and one without that head tracking. So,
yeah.
But the difference is only like $30. Yeah.
Which, you know, I don't think anybody really needs the head. I love that they did a version without the head tracking, because I think the head tracking is useless unless you're a content creator. I kept turning off all the Waves NX stuff. And, you know, maybe that's because I'm just old school and things should be done that way. But some pretty serious gamers out there found it a little frustrating. I also, you know, like this without Waves NX technology, an onboard amp, and a true wireless. There's so many good things going on with the driver that I was kind of I was kind of surprised actually to see this come out from HyperX, because HyperX does some very affordable, extremely good gaming headsets for the money.
Yeah, already they're driver tech, and I have one of the newest sets here that I need to get the review out. The Mix. Those sound great. Those are good for just walking around listening to audio. And if you have a mobile device that supports aptX, and I've been using a Samsung Galaxy phone for a little while now, it is so much better to go with like an aptX connection over standard Bluetooth like SBC or even AAC codec. It's noticeable. And I have the developer options enabled so I can actually flip between them on the fly. And you just hear the sound completely open up and sound almost like it's plugged in. So already I consider them like a higher end headphone option that I have to grab around the house. If I don't want to worry about wires, and they have at the price point that they go for, it was already pretty compelling even for music listening beyond just its gaming capabilities. So I was curious to see them come out with a much higher end option as far as like very high end price point. I think Sennheiser has a gaming headset in the $300 range. Mm-hmm. And so they're joining them with like that really high end option, but I will be interested to see what the actual like traction is for planar magnetic in gaming headphones. Not that I'm complaining. I mean, I think it's great to introduce it and get people to listen to it. And it absolutely does have like really like solid bass response on top of everything else we talked about that planar can do.
It is an excellent sounding headphone. It's just, you know, $300 or $400. I would have loved to have seen the extraordinary sound from this stereo headphone to be unencumbered by the expensive, you know, or maybe it's just, you know, the margins that Odyssey gets. I think a less expensive version of this without the Waves and X stuff would be utterly fantastic. Because one of the things I'm kind of curious about for HyperX is, you know, does it retain the setting changes you make? Does it reset itself every time you restart it? There were some minor details. And there are a lot of controls on the Mobius version. And I haven't gotten eyeballs on this one. But the, you know, there was a separate microphone level wheel and volume level wheel, and both of those are clickable to change settings. And there's just a lot going on in this. You know, there's a switch here, there's a button here, there's a button here. There's a little bit of a learning curve to figure out how to handle all of the controls on this. And it's fun to nerd out with. And I will say that there are a lot of people out there that think the 360-degree audio environment from Waves NX is absolutely fantastic. So if you get a chance to experience it, you certainly should, and, you know, see how you feel about it. I think we were both extremely excited about one of Dell's announcements. And again, my CES coverage is sponsored by Dell. Don't get angry, but this is really cool. I'll let Sebastian talk about it.
Okay, so imagine if you took a desktop computer and crammed it into a laptop. The Dell, what is it, the Area 51M. Mm-hmm. And the Verge was, I think, the one who got the really nice, like, hands-on, inside look at it. And they have, of course, beautiful photos and video on their site covering this. But this is not just a striking-looking design, but when you actually get into it, like take the bottom cover off, there is a full-size desktop CPU in there that's just in a regular socket, and you can pull it out and put in different desktop CPUs. And while it doesn't use a desktop graphics card, it does use a modular graphics card. So however prohibitively expensive future upgrades may be, they will be possible. I know that was the promise of MXM all along, but it does, at least for the CPU and memory being just right there, and desktop class CPU alone would be a draw for a serious like desktop replacement gaming solution. But it's just a fascinating concept to me that you're putting, let's see, what is in here? 9700 to 9900K Intel CPUs in here. So a Core i9 with RTX 2080. in a laptop, which I don't know if they're even talking battery life at this point. I'm sure it's just going to be plugged in. It reminds me of the days of the luggable computer form factor, where, you know, preceding laptops when you would essentially just put a handle on a desktop tower, like a small form factor in that era was, of course, about 40 pounds. And you had to have it directly plugged into use, or maybe there'd be some giant battery pack attached to it somewhere. But this is a just awesome to me in the I love the idea of like the bigger, thicker, much more powerful idea of that ultimate gaming laptop, which they're calling the world's fastest gaming laptop, which I don't doubt, even if it's just CPU performance. And judging by the pictures of the massive heat pipes, I'm sure that it's probably pretty adequately cooled as well.
Yeah. I was laughing because, of course, somebody in the Dell booth pulled up Solitaire on it.
Oh my gosh!
Apparently, it's kind of people have their humors, but. You know,
Solitaire at 500 frames a second.
I think they said more like 3,000 frames a second.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah, 500, vastly higher frames per second than the monitor can actually render. But it was, you know, it's big. It's a 17-inch laptop, right? So it's a lunch tray. But that level, I mean, just I like you, I, you know, they flipped that thing over, and I desperately wanted to flip it over and start undoing screws, but I didn't feel like being beaten to death by any of number of very nice engineers and marketing people that were in the Dell booth, because I wanted to see how, you know, how the card was secured in place. The fact that it's got an upgradable, you know, or the option of upgrading the CPU is mind-blowing, because we saw stuff doing this, you know, back in the 90s, where they would put a desktop, kind of a chipset. They would kind of kludge, I think is the word I would use. They would kludge a desktop motherboard inside of a PC, but they were atrocious. The battery life was measured in milliseconds. They ran hot, they ran loud. And, you know, this is a well-thought-out way to put a staggering amount of computing power in a very relatively small package with a nice monitor attached to it. And, you know, I see this showing up. I can think of, you know, video editors who would like this, people that are doing, you know, engineering applications, geoscience. I mean, there are a lot of people who use computers in strange places under difficult conditions that would really enjoy having a massive increase in power over what they can get in a laptop. And I think it's crazy and ridiculous, and I think it's pretty cool. But, you know, again, I'm a nerd, and I've, you know, deal with rendering video on laptops and editing and stuff like that. So it's pretty compelling. Again, I've been sponsored by Dell at CES 2019. Don't get angry. But this thing's, you know, I like moonshots. I like ridiculous over-the-top products that make me happy. We haven't even gotten to LG's roll-up TV, which is a 65-inch OLED that scrolls up and then retreats down into its sound bar. And it's a big sound bar. It's like 12 inches by 12 inches by 4 feet, give or take. But, you know, it's mesmerizing to watch that screen roll up, because it is just as absolutely gorgeous as any OLED that LG has ever made. And we haven't seen the measurements yet, but it is, you know, I don't get giddy over stuff, but that I was pretty giddy watching that monitor. I sat there and, you know, watched multiple monitors. They have a display where they're going up and down, and it's kind of like watching the fountain at the Bellagio. But it's, you know, there's some pretty cool stuff at CES this year.
I wonder what the MTBF is on the, like, the up and down motor mechanism for that OLED TV. Like, how many thousands of times can I demo that before I kill it? Really? Okay.
Yes. That is the number that they were talking about. I hope LG did a good job on that, because 20,000 is a staggeringly long time. I mean, you need an angry 4-year-old with a lot of free time to get through 20,000 cycles on that in any non-decade kind of length cycling period. But it's a pretty, I don't know, it was cool to watch, and they're absolutely gorgeous. Any last products you want to mention? Anything that you saw on the show floor that just absolutely grabbed you?
No, I mean, I was mostly entirely in meetings, actually, and I was there for a brief time. I mean, my favorite things were probably, like, EVGA. We already talked about that. Just, like, cool audio stuff always gets me. It kills me that I can't go to the show floor and look at just TVs. I would probably spend an extra day just geeking out over display technology if I could. I think my favorite thing was probably that 1,000-zone monitor, and you owe it to yourself to go look at it if you have the chance. But
I will try to hunt it down and find it, because that's pretty crazy. Ladies and gentlemen, if you are curious to see NVIDIA's GTX 2600 benchmarks, you should head over to PCPer.com, which oddly enough is the home of Mr. Sebastian Peak and his benchmarking efforts. It is a fantastic place to read reviews, and you should be dancing over there right now, because he is probably going to run to another part of his house and hit buttons and make cards go. Actually, the testing rack is behind you on the screen.
That's true. Right here.
He's going to turn his chair around.
Yeah, I'll just turn around and get right back to benchmarking like I was doing all the way up until I got on a plane to go to CES. And because the story isn't done. Like, you can read my initial review of the RTX 2060 now at PCPer.com. But there's more testing to do. Like, I didn't have a chance to even get to the 1440 numbers. I did full HD and UHD. So I need to fill in the middle there, get the 1440 stuff done. There's going to be a follow-up article. So there's plenty of stuff coming as well that we can't necessarily talk about. But exciting stuff in the works. Even though CES is almost over, there will be a lot to read in the coming weeks.
Oh, and if you don't know about it, Shannon Morris and I host a show called Tech Thing, and you can head over there and see lots of things that were not inside of meeting rooms at CES 2019. Go up to youtube.com/techthing. We got a ton of videos posted up there you can look at, including later on today or early tomorrow morning, we'll have Robert Herron talking about the best TVs and the new TV technology that came out at CES 2019. Shannon and I are in a few minutes or a few hours. Sometime time loses something in Las Vegas, especially at CES. But we will be recording a whole bunch of our favorite picks at the show. We've got a bunch of high-resolution videos, so you can see what's going on with some of the products we were talking about in the show today. And, man, I should point out, if you're looking for a new laptop, keep an eye out on youtube.com/techthing, because I think how many laptops, Shannon just walked up, how many laptops were in your video of laptops from CES?
I think I had, like, six or seven.
Yeah,
and that was just what I saw.
There are a lot of laptops here. And if you like laptops and you're thinking about upgrading, you should definitely check out that video, youtube.com/techthing. And I am going to, run and start uploading and downloading video again, because it's that time of day, people, to get the production on. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been watching This Week in Computer Hardware. We call it Twitch. You can find older episodes up at twit.tv/Twitch, including all the information on how to subscribe. As I mentioned before, Sebastian Peak can be found at PC Per. You can find me at tekthing.com or avxl.com. And we hope you have enjoyed this episode of the show, and we hope you will keep watching it in the future. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Sebastian Peak.
We'll catch you next week on Twitch.